6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Fighting in Syria continued on several fronts ahead of the planned ceasefire arranged by the U.S. and Russia in talks with Geneva. Clashes, including airstrikes, were reported around Aleppo and the capital, Damascus. Combat is supposed to end at sundown today and last for about 48 hours, could be extended to a week. Ceasefire has been welcomed by most major players in the conflict. Rebel factions, however, have some mixed reaction. Analyst David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas calls it a step in the right direction, but it does face numerous obstacles.
There's fragmentation on both sides of the conflict. The opposition has been fragmented all along. There's going to have to be a lot of leeway, as there was last February, in terms of continuing sporadic fighting. What is the tipping point toward breakdown or not? People will have to determine that.
Lesh also questions how it can hold without a mechanism for compliance. In a setback to Libya's unity government, fighters loyal to Eastern General Khalifa Haftar seized two oil ports, Ras Lanuf and Al Sidra terminals on the Mediterranean coast, and a third is being contested. Haftar opposes the UN-backed government of National Accord, and the seizure would complicate the efforts to restart production and fund its operations. Rescuers over the weekend pulled 3,400 migrants to safety on the Mediterranean off the Libyan coast. Italian Coast Guard said hundreds Sunday had left Libya aboard 8 overloaded inflatable dinghies and 2 fishing vessels. More than 14,000 have been rescued in a 5-day span. This is VOA News. Early results from Croatia's parliamentary election shows the conservative Croatian Democratic Union, or HDZ, likely will win the most seats, but not enough to rule on its own, setting up for another coalition government. Andrej Plenković is president of HDZ.
The HDZ, as the biggest and the strongest Croatian party, is into the business of uniting rather than dividing Croatian society. I want European values and European priorities to be every day on the agenda of the future government, on the agenda of the future Croatian parliament.
With more than half the votes counted, the HDZ is on track to win at least 62 seats, followed by the Liberal Social Democrats Party, the People's Coalition, with 52 seats. Whichever party ends up on top, it will have to turn to the reformist, center-right most party and its projected 12 seats to negotiate a ruling majority. The United States on Sunday marked the 15th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks when Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked 4 planes, flew them into the World Trade Center in New York, the Pentagon near Washington, while one crashed in rural Pennsylvania. In New York, they slowly read the names of all who died on September the 11th. This woman's husband was among them.
My husband was an astrophysicist, and I used to call him my star polisher.
President Obama took part in the Pentagon ceremony.
We remember, and we will never forget, the nearly 3,000 beautiful lives taken from us so cruelly, including 184 men, women, and children here, the youngest just 3 years old.
Both major party presidential candidates attended the New York ceremony. Hillary Clinton took ill while there, had to leave. Her doctor said the Democratic nominee was diagnosed with pneumonia, but is, in his words, recovering nicely. The director of U.S. Central Intelligence, John Brennan, warned Sunday on American TV of Russia's exceptional, capable, and sophisticated hacking capabilities and said the U.S. must be diligent.
Their intelligence services are quite active around the world, and this is something that we have to make sure that we're on guard for, not just for our national security purposes, but also for making sure that our system of government here is going to be preserved.
Brennan acknowledged an investigation is underway into allegations that Russia had hacked the Democratic National Committee emails, calling that criminal activity. He said the U.S. must be wary of what Moscow might be up to in trying to influence November's U.S. election. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com and always on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Monday, September 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. We look at life in New York City as the U.S. observed the 15th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks.
You have magnificent new towers that are standing. You have Tower 3 rising. You have the new transportation hub, and you have this magnificent memorial in the center of it. So it is a place now of commemoration and of life.
That's Alice Greenwald, curator of the 9/11 Memorial Museum. The death toll has risen from Saturday's 5.9 magnitude earthquake in Tanzania. Zambia's main opposition, UPND, will boycott tomorrow's inauguration of President Edgar Lungu. And Burundi denies East African leaders are disappointed in the slow pace of political dialogue in the country.
President Mkapa was very clear in saying that this government is a legitimate government. And basically, the opposition has been called to accept it as a legitimate government in order for the government to accept to talk to them.
That's Burundian Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe. Victims of Boko Haram return to devastated areas that lack basic services. And Nigeria eyes its railroad revival. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. Sunday observed the 15th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks that killed 3,000 people in Lower Manhattan's Ground Zero. The nation paid solemn tribute to all who had fallen, from New York to the Pentagon to a field outside Shanksville in Pennsylvania. One by one, relatives and loved ones of 9/11 victims recited the names of the nearly 3,000 victims who died that day. President Barack Obama, after a private moment of silence at the White House, laid a wreath at the Pentagon and delivered a message of unity. In the 15 years since the attacks, New Yorkers have witnessed Lower Manhattan's resurgence. Visitors and residents say the city feels safe today, but for many, their outlook on everyday life has forever changed. Viewer's Ramon Taylor reports.
One World Trade Center stands where the Twin Towers once did. Even taller than the original, the complex serves as a symbol of the city's resilience and strength. Despite the healing that has taken place, both locals and tourists agree, the city and the world will never be the same.
I think the world in total, it's not more safe than it was then. I think it's worse.
Wherever I go, I feel safe. However, unfortunately, these things can happen wherever you are.
Inside the 9/11 Memorial Museum, visitors explore the global impact of the 2001 attacks while reliving intimate accounts of grief and recovery. The museum's director says that at this year's anniversary, the progress at Ground Zero is evident.
You have magnificent new towers that are standing. You have Tower 3 rising. You have the new transportation hub, and you have this magnificent memorial in the center of it. So it is a place now of commemoration and of life.
But even after the last tower is finally complete, the building will continue. Ask any local who was in New York that day in 2001, and their darkest memories will come rushing back.
There were people who were involved and working in that area, and they came to school to pick up their kids. They were full of plaster.
I remember the smells from riding the subways days after and not knowing what it was because there were stores that had closed because food was spoiling. And you wondered if what you were smelling was decaying bodies.
Within sight of One World Trade Center rests a manicured garden where there was once a jailhouse. Betsy Randolph sees this as a metaphor.
I'm surrounded with all this beauty and lushness. And underneath this is a history of what this once was. And look how far we've come. You could say that about 9/11 and post-9/11. Look how far we've come.
The garden is an oasis, a place where New Yorkers can reflect and find peace. But even in the city's quieter areas, New Yorkers have mixed feelings about whether they are safer overall.
I actually feel more in danger because of the provocation, because of separatism.
We enjoy a state of extreme security, safety, and there's someone responsible for that. There's someone invisible taking care of us.
Despite their concerns and differences, many New Yorkers who survived the city's darkest hour can still agree on one thing. There is no place they would rather be. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
The Burundian government says it remains committed to a dialogue with the opposition, but will not negotiate with those who try to take power by use of force. Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe denies that East African community leaders who met last week in Arusha, Tanzania, were disappointed in the lack of progress in the inter-Burundian dialogue intended to end the country's political crisis.
The leadership in the region has, from day one, taken the matter into their own hands. They have called for an intensive dialogue, which has been hampered by a number of factors which were not necessarily in the hands of the government. When, for instance, we're talking about the events which have overshadowed the political process in Burundi, we're talking about those refugees who were recruited from the refugee camps in Rwanda and trained to go and attack Burundi. We're talking about those radical opposition members who launched grenades at civilians. We're talking about all those violent incidents which have come to really, you know, portray in bad light the political process. But from day one, the government has been committed to dialogue. Not only has the government been committed to dialogue, it has also spearheaded an internal dialogue to allow all the citizens of the country to express themselves on the political situation and then on the way forward. So I guess saying that the leaders were not happy or disappointed that the crisis has gone so long would be a bit going too far. Actually, they were more of an encouraging, rather, the facilitator and all the stakeholders to get involved of talking to each other.
Does your government still believe that you do not want to negotiate with certain elements of the opposition? Because I think people see this as a stumbling block.
No, it is not a stumbling block, James. We're talking about democracy. And when talking about democracy, you're talking about respect of principles and rules governing democracy. How do you want us, James? Just think about it this way. If there was a group of people who would want to overthrow the institutions in the United States of America by arms and eventually fail to attain their goal, would they be welcome to any dialogue to restore democracy? I really don't think that that would be the case. If that wouldn't be the case there, how would it be the case here? And then what do you make of the legal provisions that we already have in the context of the African Union, which call for the respect of democratic institutions and no acceptance of unconstitutional changes of government?
So, Mr. Minister, where is your government in terms of some things that I think you have agreed on, say the deployment of an African Union human rights and military observers, and also a UN monitor of security? Where are we on this situation?
I think it's fair to say that the government of Burundi has never opposed the African Union human rights observers and military experts. Never. We've had some disagreements with the AU Commission on some terms to use within the memorandum of understanding, but as we speak, a number of those monitors are already on the ground, despite the lack of that legal text. That's one. Secondly, on the UN police contribution, I think our government has been very clear, has indicated its position based upon the lack of popularity of that concept in Burundi. I mean, how do you want to deploy police elements in a country where they will not be very, very much welcome?
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Today is Monday, September 12th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Tomorrow, Tuesday, is inauguration day for Zambian President Edgar Lungu for his first five-year term in office after being re-elected in last month's election. The government has declared today, Monday, a half-working day and tomorrow, Tuesday, a national holiday. There are reports that the leaders of four African countries, namely Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Botswana, and Uganda, will attend the inauguration. But the opposition, United Party for National Development, which candidate Hakainde Hichilema lost the election to President Lungu and has challenged the results, says it will not attend the inauguration. Cornelius Mwitwa, a member of parliament and deputy spokesman of the UPND, says the inauguration is a celebration of what he calls the theft of the August election.
Well, I do not expect, quite honestly, any Zambian to be asking the UPND to be present at that kind of an inauguration, knowing pretty well that that is an inauguration which should have been inaugurating the president of the UPND. So the Patriotic Front, after all the illegalities we can go by with their inauguration, and I know that even them do not expect the UPND to be in attendance. Of course, they can make a smokescreen call to say, let everybody come. Of course, they have declared that Monday is going to be half day, working half day, and Tuesday will be a holiday. To try and create a face, like what is happening is something which is very popular, which will go down with everybody. This is something which many civil servants, those who are working for the government, that holiday, they will use it to mourn the loss of a better pay. They will use it to mourn the loss of good governance. They will use it to mourn the loss and defeat of the rule of law. They will use it to reflect how they must now prepare to continue to work under very, very difficult style of leadership and governance for another 5 years.
Your party keeps talking about the rule of law. One would say, yes, there's a rule of law now because the Constitutional Court has ruled that President Lungu has won. So why not respect the rule of law?
The Constitutional Court never ruled that President Lungu won because they never gave an opportunity for the petitioners to lay the evidence before the court and make submissions to that effect, upon which they would therefore pass judgment, make determination on the weight of the evidence that would have been put before it. Instead, after advising the petitioner that the case was going to start last Friday and end the following week, on the day when they said that the hearing will start on that particular day, the Constitutional Court converged itself and said, no, actually the ruling we made was the wrong one. Today, your case is not just starting and ending next week. It is starting and ending in the next 4 hours.
If you are not going to attend the inauguration, what other remedy does your party have to the court ruling?
Our party is still pursuing avenues in court, and I think that tomorrow there should be some activity at court with the legal team of the UPND trying to appeal to the Supreme Court on the question that in terms of the Constitution of the Republic, and in particular, in terms of Article 28 of the Constitution, one who feels that their rights have been violated have the right to move the court in respect of the rights that have been violated. In this particular case, the Constitution provides that there shall be, in a case where there are litigants, there shall be the right, the litigant shall have the right to a fair hearing, fair trial, which shall include a fair hearing of the matter.
Cornelius Mwitwa is a member of parliament and deputy spokesman of the opposition United Party for National Development of Zambia. He was speaking with me from Lusaka. The UN Refugee Agency reports that hundreds of internally displaced people in northern Nigeria are returning home to their villages and towns that they were forced to flee to escape the brutal onslaught of Boko Haram militants. The UNHCR warns that these returns may be premature as their areas are devastated and lack basic services. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Nigerian armed forces have retaken many areas in northeastern Borno state, formerly controlled by Boko Haram insurgents. Since these towns and villages are once again accessible, the UN Refugee Agency says it expects a growing number of internally displaced people will decide to leave their camps and go home in the coming weeks. And this, says UNHCR spokesman Leo Dobbs, is a matter of concern, as these areas have been devastated under Boko Haram rule. He says many of the internally displaced will be going back to destroyed homes and infrastructure, to areas that lack essential services. Despite these dire conditions, he tells VOA, many of the people appear to be happy to be returning home.
And they're citing, as I mentioned, the conditions that they've been living in. They've been living in terrible conditions, many of them. And they are voting with their feet, as it were. But we want to stress that they need to have the right information. They should not be going back to areas which lack basic services, healthcare, and where they can get food, potable water.
The UNHCR stresses the returns should be voluntary and safe. Dobbs says security remains a big concern. Although Boko Haram has been chased out of Borno State, he says aid agencies cannot move around without a military escort. He says the protection of IDPs returning home must be increased and improved. The UNHCR reports most of the displaced are women, children, and the elderly. It says this group is particularly vulnerable to becoming sick and malnourished if they do not receive shelter, health care, food, and safe water. It says women and girls in particular are at risk of being sexually violated and are in need of protection. The UNHCR estimates the Boko Haram insurgency has displaced more than 2.5 million people in northeastern Nigeria since 2014. This figure includes nearly 190,000 refugees in neighboring Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The death toll from Saturday's 5.9 magnitude earthquake in Tanzania has risen to at least 13, and President John Magufuli has canceled a planned trip to Zambia to attend tomorrow's inauguration of President Edgar Lungu. George Unjogopa is VOA Swahili service stringer in Dar es Salaam. He says the government will give a news conference today, Monday, to provide details on the extent of the earthquake's impact.
Right now, we have the information from the government that they're saying that the earthquake was very magnitude, and the government is trying to report the number of people to the place where the city has happened. Until now, the number of people have been passed away is about 14, and our president is about to go to Zambia, but has postponed the trip to Zambia. He now deliberately making the move to concentrate on the issue happening now. Tomorrow, the government is going to make a press conference to describe what happened in the place. And we understand that from tomorrow, the government would be going to one house to try to identify what has been happening.
Did you say the president was going to go to Zambia but has postponed that trip?
Press release from the government says that the president was about to go to Zambia to mark the inauguration of the new president in Zambia, but he has to postpone it because he'll be dealing with this earthquake on Bukoba. So President Magufuli has decided to send his assistant to Zambia. And then the President Magufuli will be dealing with what's happening in 2 days. So he has decided to send the troop in the press where what has happened in the place. We'll be conducting the survey in the area from today. We'll be making a national president speech. We'll be describing on the issue the government will be doing on helping these people who've been suffering on these issues.
George, the place where the earthquake took place, how populated is the place?
It's very populated areas where we can have a number of people that have been engaging in the cultivation, in farming. Number one is the farming areas. Number two is about the place where you can make a number of issues about economic issues.
How many people does the government know have been injured?
A report from the local government say that about 110 something that people have been injured, and the prime minister just has released a report that we are going to make survey on the area that we have been affected with this earthquake. From that moment, they will be conducting house-to-house survey. Then from tomorrow, they'll be having an exact number. Those people have been affected with the earthquake, then they're going to provide exact number. Then local government will be helping to find how they can help these people have been affected too.
George, thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much.
George Unjogopa is the VOA's Swahili service stringer, speaking with us from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. In Africa's most populous country, the car is king. Nigeria relies on its road network for most of its transportation needs. But this month, a train full of cattle arrived in the economic capital, Lagos. It's a step towards revitalizing Nigeria's neglected rail system and boosting trade within the country. VOA's Chris Stein hopped on board for the final leg of the journey and has this report from Lagos.
It's a sight not seen in 30 years. Exactly 36 hours after it left the northern town of Gusau, a train arrived at Okoba Abattoir in Lagos, carrying 15 wagons of cattle. Like most things in Nigeria, cattle usually arrives at this market by road. But the roads are overcrowded and under-maintained. Many are lined with checkpoints. Some locals complain they're used just to collect bribes. Butcher Suleiman Dauda says it's not a reliable system.
The problem of the road is that sometimes go slow, we hold loss for road. Sometimes the motor will spoil on the road. All these kind of problems.
Train tracks built during the British colonial period crisscross Nigeria, but the rail system was not maintained. Shacks have popped up along the disused rail lines. Those built in Okoba were demolished shortly before the cattle train arrived. Passenger rail service between Nigeria's two largest cities restarted in 2012. These cattle arriving in Okoba are the first of their species to ride the rails in Nigeria since the 1980s.
The reliance on road has been too much over the last few years. The whole concept of the federal government of Nigeria is to find an alternative means of transport, and the ready-made alternative is right here, which is the train. The issue has been whether the train will be reliable. It is now reliable. Is it available? It is now available.
Cows are also herded overland, but that has sparked clashes between herdsmen and farmers who complain cattle trample their crops. The miles of walking also cause injuries among the cattle. Traders say these cows are in better shape.
You can benefit from it in 2 years, in the transportation, low cost of the transportation, and in the health of our cows.
The next step is to increase the frequency of the cattle shipments and start bringing other agricultural products from northern farms to consumers across Nigeria. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, September 12th.
I think the highly welcomed attitudinal change initiative of President Muhammadu Buhari, which is reminiscent of the war against discipline the Nigerian leader launched as a military head of state over 3 decades ago, should be embraced as a two-way signal between the people and the government. While the time for introspection by a majority of the Nigerian citizenry is seemingly overdue, it is high time the Buhari administration continued to keep the beat going on the task of fulfilling its social contract to the people. Thank you, your loyal listener, Ambrose Ajio from Makurdi in Borno State of Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of news. Hillary Clinton's doctor says the Democratic presidential candidate has been diagnosed with pneumonia, but is recovering nicely. Dr. Lisa Bardack made the announcement Sunday after Clinton left a September 11 commemoration ceremony in New York. She stumbled and her knees appeared to buckle as she was helped into her car. Ace drove her to her daughter Chelsea's New York apartment to rest. That's it for this Monday, September 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a productive one.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou will discuss malaria research breakthroughs with her guest, Professor Kelly Shibali, researcher, University of Cape Town. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.